Right now, once again, it's time to be joined by our good friend David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat. The Media Beat is heard live on a Friday morning and also rebroadcast on the weekend and following our Monday noon news block here on Robinhood Radio. David, of course, is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has his own great website, themediabeat.us, and we're always very happy to have him join us on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Hello there. Good to be with you from New York City, the media capital of the world. And an interesting bit of meteorological reporting to be done here. New York City is a long way from the West Coast, as you know, but we've been suffering the last few days from overcast skies caused by the wildfires of California and Oregon. How about that as a nightmarish scenario for global warming and the notion of end of days? It's terrifying.
It's interesting because we have the same phenomena up here, and people take pictures of it because, first of all, it is a very strange way to look at the sun. But what you say is exactly correct. I mean, we have had volcanoes spread ash around the world and dim the sunlight. We have had some fires that have done this, but for us to sit here on the East Coast and for one solid week to have the sun dimmed by fires from Oregon and California is quite simply amazing.
Well, it reinforces the notion that we are all in this together. It is a global phenomenon, after all. However much the deniers might try to deny it, particularly the denier-in-chief, of course. But it's just one aspect of this crazy election campaign in which truths and untruths are flying around with extraordinary rapidity and force.
You know, it's interesting. We have a great geologist here and a historian, Ed Kirby, and when he talks about climate change, he's somebody that looks at geology. And as he says, you know, the term is used the wrong way with a lot of people. I mean, the Earth is constantly changing, and we can't stop that slow onward change and the cycles that the Earth goes through. But we can stop and try to affect what is happening. And I've had numerous people send me emails and letters.
Especially the man-made elements of it, of course.
That's it.
I imagine that's the distinction that he's drawing,
yeah,
right?
The man-made elements. And, when I report on climate change, when I report on these fires, I get emails and letters from people that say, they'll show me a picture of fires, and they'll say, why do the fires start here? And I try to tell them, no, you don't understand. Climate change doesn't necessarily start fires, but once fires start,
right,
the effects of climate change give far more fuel than ever before for those fires to spread quickly and in ways that firefighters never imagined.
Right, and it's something of a generalization, I know, but it is an undeniable truth, and it's been predicted for decades now that global warming will bring with it an enormous spread of extreme weather of all kinds. The Santa Ana winds in California, for instance, which are an element in the equation, are that much fiercer and that much more frequent because of global warming, and all that contributes as well.
Yeah, it's a topic that is more than just two words, and if people actually took time just to look at all the things, because I get that too. How come the fires stop at the Canadian border? Well, I respond with the fact, well, if you look back at last year, just north of the U.S. in Canada, in that section, they had major forest fires. That fuel in Canada, in that particular section, was all burned up last year. Just like these fires that start in California and Oregon, they're not in areas where there was previous fires. People just don't want to take the time to really investigate and understand the long-term effects of what we have done with climate change. And you can't even call it climate change. You can call it human effect on climate change. That's really what it should be called.
Yeah, and you're right. It doesn't, and it's not as if it you have to be a have a master's degree in meteorology to understand this. It's a fairly rapid read through some pretty simple concepts, but it does take a little bit of time. I mean, as we say in this the Media Beats segment so many times, the onus is upon us as the consumers of media to understand it, and it's our job to do a little bit of the lifting ourselves. Just read, for instance. It's a much underrated form of getting to understand things. Just take the time to read something.
All right. Well, we'll take a break for a second and go to the worldwide. Take a worldwide view of the pandemic. Once again, now Europe is facing a crisis point people are calling it the second wave, even though I don't think the first wave ever really left. And we have states in the United States now. We have 18 states that now, once again, are on the uptick with the coronavirus. This is a story that just is not going to go away from our lives in the foreseeable future.
Absolutely not. And in the industrialized world, which country is now the only one and who knows what will happen in the near future, but the only country currently about to shut down again in a complete repeat of the lockdown of earlier is Israel. Where, again, like so many other places, a certain amount of hubris crept into the fact that they, after a while with the first lockdown, managed to curb the infection numbers and the mortality numbers, but have found them creeping and then starting to get very much faster or upward tick, and are now having to shut down the nation's economy once again. There are lessons to be learned here, that and one of them is, I think, the what you were alluding to. Who knows that these are waves? I mean, who could really say that honestly and thoroughly if you look at the evidence? Where has it actually gone away? And therefore, you know, give rise to the notion of a second wave. In most places, it just simply has continued and perhaps varied a bit in its strength and its rapidity of transmission. But it's still with us, and it's likely to stay with us for some time.
And what's interesting is when we talk about vaccines, vaccinations, if you look at the reports from the companies around the world that are involved in this together, there's three things they make apparent. Yes, they are very close to a certain vaccine, which towards the end of October or sometime in November, they might actually have a basis to go from. But here's what people don't realize is that you then take those vaccines, you have to produce enough of them over a period of time. You have to transport them to go to the correct places at the right time, keep them at a certain temperature. And all the vaccines that are being put together right now are for adults.
Which brings up the question, of course, of how thorough is the testing process going to be. Of course, it has to be extremely thorough. The FDA in this country is insistent upon that, and for very good reasons. That's historically been true, and any attempt to cut corners, this administration's emphasis on what they call warp speed. I remember the president giving us a little translation of that phrase. He said, warp speed, that means something big and something fast. Well, I'm not sure it does mean something big, but of course, in this president's mind, almost anything that's important has to be called big. But the testing process has to be figured into the whole equation for developing the drug, and testing is every bit as important as formulating the compound in the first place. And as you say, we don't know what its effect is yet, and this will take an extra round of testing on people who are not adults. and other categories of people who might have specific vulnerabilities as well. An awful warning came out of the Oxford development, Oxford University's progress towards a vaccine had this setback when one individual was having very bad side effects and so bad, in fact, that the development of that particular strain of vaccine was halted for a bit, and of course changed direction in some degree. So yes, don't count on the end of October, on November. And bear in mind, of course, as every consumer of media output must do, that election seasons are always prone to produce what in the trade are called October surprises, and we must factor in the notion that it could be there's a suspicion, and a justified suspicion in many people's minds, I think, that American efforts are being hastened along in order to give the administration something to present of a positive nature before November the 3rd.
Well, and what's interesting about that is, and this is where I don't understand the president and his advisors. I do understand the president is running the country like he ran his company, and at 70 years old and plus, so we wouldn't be any different, not necessarily listening to advisors, but to the bombshells which came out about his interviews and about when he knew about it. It's so interesting to look back that if he had been honest back in the end of January and early February, we would be sitting in a whole different place death-wise. We would be sitting in a whole different place actually worried. I don't think we'd be quite as worried as we are now, simply because we would have really handled it differently. Had everything been up front. But it appears now that our first shutdown might have gone for naught, and that's disastrous, because the stock market doesn't represent the true economy. The true economy represents Main Street businesses across this country, and I can tell you right now, as a broadcast operation, even though we're nonprofit, Main Street America took this shutdown far harder than Wall Street ever will. Wall Street rebounds quickly, and if there's another significant wave of this in this country, there's going to be a financial crisis that stems from local businesses to people who own buildings that rent, to people who rent those apartments in those buildings. We have a massive problem that is on the horizon that it doesn't seem to have hit people's minds yet.
Yeah, I don't think there is an industry in this country or in any developed country that has escaped the effects of the pandemic. I mean, we can say perhaps rather glibly that the high-tech industries and maybe the instant online purchasing and delivering industry like Amazon may have gotten a big boost out of it, but otherwise every single realm of the economy has been affected, and of course, you know, that's not necessarily, and in fact isn't at the moment, being reflected by the stock market. But eventually the stock market is fundamentally affected, influenced at least, by what are sometimes called the fundamentals of the economy. And that's real. That's an expression, really, of real economic life. I mean, the real economy of this country has taken one hell of a hit, and it already shows some signs of pulling back, but from a terribly low baseline from the summer, and no indication that our recovery is going to be anything else but extremely slow, and of course may well be interrupted dramatically again.
Now, what's compare. We had a chance this week, if you watched them, to see the President of the United States and Joe Biden, who was running against the President of the United States for presidency. They both held town halls. And a lot of time elections, when you have Republicans and Democratic candidates up there, the words might be a little different, but basically it's the same. It's the same presentation. Well, there is a definitive choice this year in Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Just in simply, if you look at the way they both handled their town halls with Americans asking them questions, it really is striking. I'm, like I said, I'm 67. I've been interested in politics basically since Robert Kennedy, and I have never seen quite a difference between two approaches, two personalities, and then you add the policies in that we have running right now for President of the United States.
Yeah, are you thinking back to Nixon versus Kennedy? The first televised debate, that was an extraordinary study in contrasts, and I think you're obviously seeing a great study of contrast of politics, but a very different media presentation as well. I mean, as a media critic, I'd say that it was a very illuminating distinction being demonstrated to us this last week. Trump was extraordinarily ill at ease with taking questions out of his normal comfort zone. His normal comfort zone is, of course, Fox News. And there he was in an ABC setting, organized by ABC, and with members of the public who were, we were told, were largely undecided voters. And ordinary members of the public have a capacity for putting politicians who expect to be deferred to on the spot very effectively, and that's certainly what happened with Trump. He was on the back foot almost throughout that performance, if that's what we should call it. Biden, on the other hand, not necessarily not at all, in my personal view, the Sleepy Joe caricature that Trump is trying to assign to him. He was, and of course, just in terms of, 40, 50 years in politics, he's well used to talking to people who take a different position from him. Trump has only one way of dealing with that, which is trying to bluster, and Biden tried to reason with people. I mean, it's a very, very clear and classic distinction between two presentational styles.
Now, as somebody who looks at our country and is and by the way, is a United States citizen, but can look at it I like to call it an expert from afar. When you look at some of the things that our Attorney General said this past week, it just brings into focus how closed of a loop right now we have between the President of the United States and the leader of the Justice Department, and then the separation between Bill Barr as being the leader of the Department of Justice and the people who go out there and work, whether or not they're attorney generals or whatever. I mean, there is a crisis now in confidence in the way things are handled.
You mentioned my capacity for looking at America as something of an outsider. I'll take that on quite happily. I think journalists generally need to try and get as much distance on the country that they're reporting on, even if it's the country that they live in. And as you say, I'm now a citizen of the United States too. But I've reported for, I tried to count once. I think it's about 72 countries I've reported on. And many of them have been what Americans often call, somewhat dismissively, I fear, third world countries. And in that phrase, there's something of a dismissal of poor countries with corrupt regimes running them, and an appalling abuses of democracy taking place, and I sure have reported on a lot of those. And there's something about Attorney General Barr when he suggests, for instance, just one instance, protesters in the streets that he, of course, calls rioters and looters, should be prosecuted for sedition, i.e. Trying to undermine the government of the United States by force. That reminds me of those very, very corrupt and undemocratic regimes that I've reported on around the world. The shorthand for that in journalese is a banana republic. Those were the echoes that I was getting as I listened to Barr this week. Yes, acting not so much as the head of our justice system, very much acting as if he was the enforcer of a president trying to get elected on a platform of basically anti-democratic tendencies towards autocracy, indeed.
Well, do we have another media beat recognition coming up this week of journalism?
Well, I think some good journalism has been done. I want to play a fanfare for a particular combination of skills that came out well in a journalistic triumph this week. Are we having the fanfare? And it's a well-owed fanfare for, as I say, a combination. It's a classic combination here of a source, a whistleblowing source, in fact, a legal or advocacy organization that formulates the issue in good and clear terms, and journalistic outlets. And what I'm talking about is a whistleblower called Dawn Wooten, who is a nurse in a particular detention center in Georgia, the Irwin Detention Center, operated by ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. She revealed the story initially to poverty and anti-injustice campaigning organization in Georgia, rather like the Southern Poverty Action Group in Alabama. This one is in Georgia, and it's called Project South. And her whistleblowing was about the nightmarish story of women in this immigrants' detention center in Georgia being forced to have, against their will, without their consent, surgical operations, hysterectomies in many cases, or other forms of gynecological surgery that left them infertile. horrible echoes of sterilization campaigns. And the story was taken to The Intercept and to The Takeaway in public radio, and it was so well handled, so well reported, not just the legal case that the Project South was taking against ICE and the particular detention center, but extra reporting done by Jose Olivares, who's an associate producer of The Takeaway, and John Washington, who works often, he's a freelance journalist who works for publications like The Nation and, in this case, The Intercept. And they put that story together with their very thorough reporting independently of the whistleblowers. So it was all very well corroborated. And Jose Olivares even spoke to the surgeon who conducted some of these surgeries without informed consent. And the whole thing worked so well that, of course, it became a cause célèbre in The Nation. And while ICE apparently tried to deport a key witness, a woman who indeed had one of these operations unwillingly, they tried to deport her to Cameroon, a country that she hadn't lived in since she was 2 years old. And she was only rescued, as it were, according to the House of Representatives members who got onto this case and have taken it to a national outcry level, and she was only rescued on the tarmac of the airport where she was about to be flown out. ICE have a different story, of course. They say there was some documentation problem that prevented her from being flown out of the country, but she's still in the country. The story is being fully ventilated now, and I think this is a good example of investigative journalism at its worst, at its best, when it's working with a whistleblower and taking good care to double check everything before it reports.
I just, you know, we sit here and we look at this, David, and we look at I've said this before on numerous times. If you were to take all the events that have happened in this administration and would say 10 years ago presented them to a company to do a movie or a television series, they would have thought you were absolutely crazy.
Sure. This, like I say, this is a nightmarish quality which boggles the mind. And yet it's well reported and thoroughly presented. And in some terrible way, it's not surprising in the context of this administration. That is possibly the most nightmarish thing about it.
Well, that's the way things look right now. David, we'll speak to you next week. Have a great week.
You too.
The Media Beat with David Tarachuk here on WHDD. Sharon, WHDD, of course, the Robin Hood Radio Network.